This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And here's a question for you. Will the year-over-year change in the U.S. Consumer Price Index exceed 2.7% in May of 2025? Because the yes forecast contract recently traded at 23% and the no was at 75%. With Interactive Brokers forecast contracts, you can trade on future events like climate change, the economy, or even politics. You choose yes or no. And if you're right, you get paid. It's that simple. Explore trending data on U.S. consumer prices. Spot the trends and make your prediction. Trade forecast contracts at Interactive Brokers and earn a dollar for every correct prediction. Plus, you'll earn 3.83% APY on your investment with an interest-like incentive coupon. And you'll get $3 when you start trading forecast contracts. Now, forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors. I want you to go to ibkr.com/forecast and start predicting today. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC. Last day trading for the contract is June 19th.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets making a V recovery once again, right off the bottom, straight up to the top. Trump making deals all across the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And AI is back in vogue. Our guest today is Ed Easterling from Crestmont Holdings. All this and much more on episode number 921 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to another action-packed episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm Andrew Horowitz. I've been here, well, it's going on 2007. So 18 years doing that's amazing. I mean, what I mean by that is, oh my God, seriously? That's 18 years. 18 years doing podcasting. When we first started, it was a little known item that we had no idea what this would turn into, but it seemed like a really cool thing. I was doing radio before, by the way. Little bit of trivia, lesser known trivia. The first radio show that I ever did that I had on my own was called, wait for it, The Money Doctor. The Money Doctor Show with Andrew Horowitz. And a little also lesser known fact is there was a period of time, and I'm serious about this too, there was a period of time for about, I think it was almost a year, I was asked to fill in for a show and I was the money girl. I'm not kidding either. I had a really interesting time doing short form financial shows for this group. And it was Minion Fogarty, if I believe her name was, that was her name. And she was a quick and dirty tips. Actually helped me get published my second book. But that was pretty interesting that I was Andrew Horowitz, the money doctor and the money girl. No kidding. No kidding. Well, here we are, the Disciplined Investor. I want to talk about a couple of different things that is important, and I wanted to delve into something that I think is, I don't know. I think it's an area that is fundamental to investing, and yet at the same time, I think it's kind of overlooked. I think this is a part of successful investing that people are like, okay, well, we do this and I buy that stock and I do that. But here's the word. It's one word. It's one item. It's one strategy, if you will. It's one thing that we need to have at all times. That is consistency. Because consistency in investing is nothing more than a steady beat. It's a drum beat in a symphony, right? The constant keeps everything on track. It's the conductor, right? It's this constant, we're going to do this way. We're going to do it that way. But you know what? We're not going to go outside of that beat. We're going to keep everything in time. We're going to keep everything in sync. And what we have is this idea that when we have consistency, we can actually have everything in rhythm, in harmony. And as a seasoned investor or maybe if you're just starting out, right? The maintaining of consistency approach can be, it definitely is something that can help you achieve your financial goals. So imagine, for example, planting a tree and you don't see it grow overnight, right? But you have regular watering, proper care, proper pay. I have all of these plant-based little metaphors and stories that I have. You know that, the flower garden, right? We have the lobster trap. Everything's kind of what I do in life. And I think about that in the form of investing. But when you plant a tree or any kind of other thing that you want to have grow over time, it's the same thing with kids, right? You want to have consistency. But with a tree, with a plant, with regular watering, proper care, maybe in a little bit, a dash, dare I say, of some patience, it's going to eventually flourish into this really strong, towering presence. And investing works pretty much the same way. Because it's not about making one single spectacular, oh my God, that is the most, look at that trade. He shorted on the bottom and he bought, you know, short on the top and bought on the bottom. And he bought this stock and we could brag about my buying Apple when it was just coming out of bankruptcy or when it was going through that. Or pick whatever you want, right? It's all about making steady and informed decisions over time. So today we're going to talk about why consistency matters and how it's going to be able to help you weather all sorts of market volatility that we have and give you some practical steps in how you can build a disciplined investment strategy. I'm going to share some things that I dug up on who I think is a model for consistency, things that we know. So, all right, let's settle in. Let's get into this. Let's start with the importance. So consistency is, I think it helps us all mitigate this emotional roller coaster that we're on, right? That often occurs throughout the fluctuations of market moves. Because when you have a consistent strategy, you're less likely to make these impulsive decisions. These things that you wake up and we see that the Dow or the S&P is down 4% and, oh my God, I got to get out. And you're these short-term blips that are usually these very volatile movements, we can stay away from because if you have consistency and a strategy built upon that, you can stay focused, right? You could have these long-term goals in mind and make adjustments based on this well-thought-out plan that you already have. I always talk about this idea of, well, we have all this plan, but did you write it down? Did you write down? And the same thing with New Year's resolutions. Did you write it down? Because if you write it down, you're committing to it. If you're talking about it, it's just an idea. It's something that you hope to maybe one day, someday do. But in fact, if you write it down, it's a commitment. Right? You've heard of this, you know, writing in stone. We're etching it in concrete. So the first thing I want you to do is have some ideas on how to build an investment strategy with consistency. And what you need to do is the thing you need to do is set your goals. If you're driving down the road to some destination that you haven't decided upon before you actually even got in the car, how are you going to know where to go? You need to know where you're going. Then we can look at the map to figure out how to get there. And if in fact there are roadblocks or things that happen, well, we can make near-term adjustments, right? So we want to define this. We want to have the idea of what do we want to achieve with our investments? Maybe you could be saving for retirement. You could have a down payment on a house. Maybe you're saving for a wedding or your kid's education. So having this clear goal is really important. Then you want to develop a plan, right? You want to have the map. So we create this detailed investment plan that outlines your strategy, maybe your asset allocation, your risk tolerance, which is really important. Because if we have a risk tolerance and a ability to understand. So one of the things we do with our clients, for example, is when they come in as new clients, we do a few different things depending on which strategy they're working with. But basically what we're doing is we're looking at a three-dimensional risk that we build for them and help them. We ask a lot of questions through an online system that we built and ask all these questions to come up with their temperament, their ability to handle risk, their goals, time horizon, all this helps us. When you have that and you create that, it's much better to understand what you should be investing in. If you're a conservative investor that wants to have just income and no fluctuation and you start buying penny stocks, I'm telling you, probably, just saying, it's not going to be a successful plan. So you want this roadmap to keep your decisions and guide you and help you stay on track, right? That's really important. Then you want to stick to your plan. And once you have a plan in place, right, it's really, it's the important thing. There's the consistency part, right? We want to stick to it. Even when the market gets turbulent, we're going to be consistent. We're going to be, listen, what's the difference between consistent investor and disciplined investor? Not much. So I'm really talking the same story here. We want to be consistent because we want to avoid that temptation to chase over the current market conditions because it can change, right? We want to make sure that the plan and what you're doing, all of it remains fully aligned. Now, sometimes, let's be honest, you get a little, you know what? That stock somebody mentioned to me, it's really not totally aligned with what I have. But you know what? That's okay too. As long as the core of what you're doing is aligned with your risk tolerance time horizon and is consistent over and over again until such time that it doesn't work and you need to make course adjustments, just like us driving for a long time. There's a traffic jam. There's an accident. There's something. There's a road closure. We got to make course adjustments. Now, we know a lot of people out there that have had consistency and some of the best results out there. What about Warren Buffett, right? I dare say known as one of the most successful investors of all time. And he's always emphasized the importance of consistency. His philosophy, in fact, is based on buying high quality companies, very simple, and holding them for a very, very, very long time, right? And this consistent approach has helped him achieve remarkable returns for how many decades? I don't know, five, six, seven decades? What about John Bogle, right? He's the founder of Vanguard Group. He was the creator of the first index fund. He always advocated for consistency. He advocated for low-cost investment strategies. And by focusing on these broad market index funds and avoiding frequent trading, his approach actually helped millions of investors achieve their financial goals. Consistency. That's our theme today, consistency. Now, here's some of the things you could do, right? You could automate your investments in order to stay consistent. You can set up automatic contributions to your investment accounts. Ensure you're consistently investing, regardless of market conditions. Automatic dollar cost averaging into your plan. Education. You want to continuously educate yourself about investing. The more you understand, well, the principles, right? The more you're going to be confident in sticking to your strategy. And you want to stay disciplined, right? Because discipline is essential for maintaining consistency. Remind yourself all the time about your long-term goals. I want you to resist the idea of, I'm going to make this impulsive decision based on these short-term market movements. I'm freaking out. Because the consistency is the cornerstone of successful investing. We want to set these goals. We want to develop a solid plan. We want to stick to it. And you can navigate the ups and the downs of the market with confidence. Remember, investing is a marathon, not a sprint. So stay consistent. Stay disciplined. And I'm telling you, you're going to be on your way to achieving your financial goals. So with that, let's get to our guest. And our guest today is Ed Easterling. He's the founder and president of Crestmont Holdings, an Oregon-based investment management and research firm that publishes provocative research on the financial markets. You can find him over at crestmontresearch.com. He's over 30-plus years of alternative investment experience, including financial markets, private equity, business operations. He's an author. He's released books like Probable Outcomes, Secular Stock Markets Insights, and Unexpected Returns, Understanding Secular Stock Markets with, 2005. He's also a contributing author to Just One Thing. That was back in 2005. Also co-authoring chapters in Bullseye Investing by John Malden. So first, how are you, sir? Nice to see you. Nice to hear you.
Yeah, absolutely. Great to be with you again, Andrew.
What was it like writing a book with John Malden?
Oh, that was really fascinating. John is such an interesting person. He has such a breadth and depth of insights into so many different things. And we were focused on the stock market and stock market returns and outlooks at the time. And that was an interesting time to be writing it too. If you think about it, that's back in the early 2000s. Boy, wasn't that ancient history at this point. And so it was a lot of fun doing that with John. I was honored that he suggested we write a chapter that turned into two and got a a color foldout in the middle of that book. Yep. For the readers of Bullseye that know, it has the stock market matrix as a centerfold, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So
very sexy.
Exactly.
You know, I view 1998. We'll say 1998. I view 1998 as the beginning of this generation's financial markets and economy. It kind of all dates back to there for me for some reason. 87, you know, that one day wonder, all that went on, all that, and some of the things like long-term capital management. But 1998, with the excessive and the excesses that were put on, and the change in how we do research from the aspect of going to the libraries on Sundays to actually having a computer where you can find information on a real-time basis, all of that, right? And then fast forward that into the time where we have excessive amounts of debt, Fed becoming a cool thing, right? To be a Fed officer, Fed official, mm-hmm. and constant bailouts. That's where it all started for me. What do you think about that?
Well, I would say, I think for one who started looking at that at the very end of the 90s, that created kind of one whole mindset and perspective, much like the Depression babies. I think for those that rode through the previous decade of the 90s and a whole lot of the emergence of .com, had their own kind of a contrasting experience. So I think you picked a good date for the modern era. I think the people who were just preceding it also kind of have, you know, had their own whipsaw experience.
Yeah. Well, don't forget the 70s, which was like hell on wheels. I remember back in the late 80s, early 90s, people we talked about investing and they said, well, I'm not investing in mutual funds. I'm like, why not? Well, do you know what happened to mutual funds in the 70s? I'm like, was there any difference in what happened with mutual funds versus stocks in the 70s? But that was like a lost decade for some people.
So true. Absolutely. And a grueling one, because it ended with, think about the interest rates and prime rate over 21%, mortgage rates 15%. And then those two just back to back with grueling recessions.
Yeah, that was a rough time. Fortunately, that didn't happen this time. But you do mention something very interesting, that it does shape our psychology. And I know you do a lot of work in this area, right? In the area of what thoughts investors have and how they make decisions, because that's all part of this whole process. But what level of importance do you put on where we've come from in how it just shapes what we're doing? I mean, is it different from, you know, growing up and starting cutting your teeth on your first investment when you're, you know, back in the 70s versus maybe in the first investment you ever had back in 2020?
Absolutely. I would say on a psychology, so a lot of Crestmont Research's work is about the long-term cycles and the fundamental drivers of stock market returns. That's very much a look from point to point over time. In the meantime, that psychology is what gives us this volatile ride that sometimes looks like a random walk for most investors in the market along a more rational ultimate outcome. So I think it's very much the psychology plays a big part in investors' ultimate returns, because if they lose sight of the fundamentals, they tend to play whack-a-mole in the market and come out behind.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about some basic things I want to talk to you about. Some things I was thinking about considering your readings, your writing, or your writings and reading your writings. What do you think? Your work often combines this, what would you call it, like deep data analysis, right? Investor psychology, which we were just talking about. The things we're talking about, are there more things that create an investor's inability to judge correctly what's going on in the markets?
Well, I think, you know, general public sentiment probably helps affect it too. You know, things that are going on in the outside world. The other is there, you know, just when we get into periods where certain speculative investments are popular, I think that can bleed over into other markets like the stock market.
Right. So when we're all excited and ramped up about, let's say, real estate, for example, or crypto, for example, or I don't know, art, whatever it is, you're saying that can just create what, like a mass euphoria
Well, you know, you see things. Well, you mentioned crypto. I think people have different opinions about whether that's a tangible asset or intangible asset. But I would say that when you see that, when an investment like that is moving with such force and volatility, I think that can, and as a general successful trend, I think that can affect people's mindset about stocks and other investments. That if double digit returns or more are available in other markets, why can't the stock market do that?
Yeah. And so we get like, we'll use that as a proxy for that's what we're comfortable investing in, and let's get in there. I assume that's right. Kind of the...
Yeah, but ultimately, I think the reality is for stocks, for example, or bonds, but stocks in particular, you know, you're not investing in a market. You're investing through the market in companies, and companies that are part of an economy, companies that who can only provide a return if they generate a profit, and profits that are generally constrained by economic conditions. So the idea that you could have perpetual double-digit returns in stocks is unrealistic.
Absurd. So you're talking about that now.
Absurd, that's a good word.
Yeah, what you're talking about is a question, a very important question. I think that is it a stock market or a market of stocks? And let me just frame that a little bit further. A lot of people are like, well, I'm not investing in the stock market because this is out of this, or I am investing. It doesn't matter which side you take. I had a discussion with somebody just today, and I was talking about how one of the greatest places to make and create wealth, destroy wealth too, but make and create wealth is the stock market, for the point of these are companies that have a goal to, you know, if you're talking about the good companies, goal to make profit and money for them. There's a lot of selfishness involved in a lot of it. And you're just riding the coattails as opposed to, oh, I'm just investing in this blank stock market, right? But that investors, sometimes they don't capture that.
I think exactly. You know, for many, those are symbols. You know, the two, three, four letter symbols that are making moves that can be 2, 3, 10% in a day, and to see it bounce around the way it does, it doesn't make sense that you're buying something that has underlying fundamental value that over the long term is bounded by those financial principles.
Yeah.
So I think when you see the same thing happening in other markets, but happening even in multiples of those changes. Again, I think at some point it reinforces a psychology that investing is about picking things that go up and just trying to pick the ones that go up more.
Yeah.
And because a lot of folks haven't been through, we've had just these brief periods, you know, this correction we had, you know, in the last couple of months. That would take 15% of the market, but here we are right back again.
These are not healthy either for investor psychology, because it's almost like, hey, it's going down. Well, we're just going to buy in at that point. Let's buy the dip. And everybody thinks that V recoveries are the norm. That, like we talked about, there was a 10-year period in 2000 that the NASDAQ didn't get above its head above water.
Right.
Or maybe it was 15 years. It was a long time. It's a very long time, a lifetime for some people. Now, I know you're an adjunct professor. Is that correct? An adjunct professor?
I was when I was back in Dallas, Texas. I did serve for 5 years as an adjunct professor at SMU's graduate business program.
All right. So if you were to design today, I was thinking about this. If you would design a basic financial curriculum, it's May, but it was April. April, of course, was Financial Literacy Month, which I think was overplayed a little bit, and people don't know what to do with it at this point, but every day is Financial Literacy Day, let's be honest. But if you were to create, let's say, I don't know, some kind of curriculum, what would be the top topics that you would make mandatory?
I think we spend a lot of time, we'd spend a lot of time talking about Warren Buffett and his philosophy on investing. I think there'd be a slight dose of economics, and a more detailed review of use the stock market history, use interest rate history as a laboratory to understand what has driven cycles in the past, what has driven returns in the past, and then follow on with some sage investors like a Warren Buffett and others that are sort of renowned for their explanations of stock markets as markets of companies, not as a market of stocks, not a not an investment itself.
Yeah, that's interesting because that's once you get that into your head, I know it sounds like a small item. We just turned the words around: stock market, market stocks, right? I think there's something to be said. Seriously, there's something to be said if you take that mentality. This is a market of stocks. So what are we dealing with here? What we want to have the best of the best. Okay, not just yes. Index investing is very popular and very powerful. I have no problem with that, right? I personally have no problem. I don't know if you do with index investing. If that's part of your plan, however. I think that it seems to me that there's also the idea that, well, what if I want to go one step further? What if I want to find the best and the cream of the crop? Like the Mag 7 was for how many years, right? Like, you know, pick your name that was just an extra. That's a way to really create wealth.
You know, I think we're digging into mutual funds, especially index investing. Index investing, basically getting the market return.
Right.
And if we're looking at diversified market basket, that is different than investing in, that's bounded by economic principles, but it is somewhat different than investing in individual companies. Because at that point, you have diversified away individual company risk and have accepted market risk. That would be more limiting in its return profile than if you were investing in a selected subset of companies.
Yeah, no, But neither is better or worse, right?
No. It's two different tools. And I think that, matter of fact, if anything, I think you're bringing out a great point that would come out in designing that course. I could see classroom session or two on that debating that topic and drilling into the fundamentals and the techniques that help distinguish between investing in an actively managed portfolio versus a indexed portfolio.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. Good stuff.
And I think another class that comes to mind as we're talking would be, I'd have a class on Benjamin Graham. I think there's something about going back 100 years and talking about principles that have endured over time. There's something that, showing that the roots of investment, fundamental investing, value investing, are very deep. I think would be helpful for those participants in the class.
Yeah, I mean that gives you, it's like, you know, it reminds me of the basic idea of, well, what do we need to learn math for now, because Excel can do it all for us. And I'll be very upfront and tell you that if you gave me a long division problem that was complicated, I'd be like, I look at that going, I know I got to put the thing over kind of over here and carry something over here. I know there's something about that and moving around and dropping lines down, you know, long division, right? I don't know if I could do it anymore, right? Because what do? We just throw it on the calculator on a computer, the calculator on a phone, ask Siri, put it into ChatGPT, or do an Excel. But if I don't understand the basic underlying principles related to mathematics, how would I even get the idea of what to do in the first place?
And I think that's what's maybe underappreciated because of the education you just described going through long division. I think there's what is now kind of an innate understanding of how that mathematical decision is being made and being processed. Even though you couldn't necessarily go through this today and do the steps of long division, you've got an appreciation for what it represents.
Of course.
And therefore, the biggest difference is when the answer comes out and the answer is an outlier over what would be reasonable, what you would intuitively know to be reasonable because you understand the formula, you can identify that you wouldn't otherwise if all you knew was how to operate a calculator.
And if I knew the formula and understand it to the core, I could then create upon that, not just regurgitate an answer. Difference between learning and memorizing.
Exactly.
Very important in the education process, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's take a break, but I want to, there's something I want to ask you about because I want to talk about secular bull and bear markets and get your opinion on something that I think is really important. And I want to also help me answer the question of, is this time different? So just hang on. We'll be right back. Let's take a second to talk about Interactive Brokers, because at Interactive Brokers, did you know this? You don't have to wait for the markets to open. With around-the-clock trading, you could trade over 10,000 U.S.-listed stocks and ETFs, U.S. equity index futures and options, U.S. Treasury bonds, and more. IBKR's overnight trading helps you stay ahead by allowing you to react instantly to market-moving news and economic events whenever they happen. Capture more market opportunities and trade on your timetable whenever it's convenient for you. Enjoy bond trading with no markups, no built-in spreads, and low transparent commissions. Open an interactive broker's account today and discover more trading opportunities at ibkr.com/aroundtheclock. Okay, we're back with Ed Easterling, and we left off with the question or the tease of what I want to talk about is about this whole item about this. You've talked about this. You've written about this a lot, the secular bull and bear markets. First, I want you to do me a favor. Just explain that to me. Tell me what that means in layman's terms. And then let's follow it up with where we are now in the current cycle and why you believe it to be the case.
Okay. So the term secular, bull and bear market, secular, that comes from a Latin word, secula, which means an era or an extended period of time. Matter of fact, if most folks will pull out a $1 bill right now and turn it over, you'll see a pyramid in the back. And there's a phrase on that that includes the word secularum, which is an era. It was an era of time that goes part of that great seal. When you apply it to stock market cycles, it says that these are stock market cycles of an era. In general, these are eras when the inflation rate is rising and causing the value of stocks to decline. And as we go through that inflation cycle, it then reverts and inflation comes back down. So if we look back over the last 100 years, we had a number of cycles that were driven very consistently by the inflation rate cycle. It also told us, in what secular stock market cycles tell us, is that when we start off with high valuations, we typically end up with relatively low returns over that next 7, 10, 20-year period. Valuation matters. Mm. Right now, we have a period of very high valuations and relatively low inflation. This is different than it has been in the past. I'm not saying it's different this time. I'm saying it's different than it was in the past in that we have significantly elevated valuations. We have elevated profit margin levels. And we have a stock market that shows a level of resilience and momentum to the upside that it's hard to categorize it right now. I would have to say it feels like a secular bull, but it has characteristics of the potential for secular bear.
All right, now you got me in limbo because I got both sides of the discussion now, right? We got a bull, but a bear. So what would be the pivot point for you? What would be the, that little grain of sand makes me say it's this or that? Market action?
You know, and Andrew, I think it's important now. That's a good point. So here's my principle that I'm trying to apply to this, and that's what makes it challenging. At Crestmont, we call it the reconciliation principle. It's that there are only three sources of returns from stocks and the stock market. One is dividend yield. Mm-hmm. Two is earnings growth. Mm-hmm. And three is the PE ratio, is the multiple of earnings. And the multiple of earnings and earnings growth combine to give us capital gains. And then you add on top of that dividend yield, and that's your total return.
Okay, I got that.
If we walk through that, right now we know the dividend yield is about 1.2%. Very low compared to the 4% average historical rate that contributed to 10% returns.
This is on, by the way, the S&P 500?
This works for any for whatever index that we would talk about. So if it's the basket of S&P stocks, by definition, they're constrained by the earnings growth of those S&P 500 companies,
right? No, but
the valuation of them, and the dividend yield. Move over to the NASDAQ, it's the same concept. But by the way, on the NASDAQ, the dividend yield will be lower.
But where's the 1.5 coming from? Is that the S&P?
The dividend yield?
Yeah,
that's an S&P number.
Okay, and actually probably- I just want to clarify that for people.
At this rally, we're probably closer to 1.2. On the S&P right now, would be about 1.2%.
And let's just mention something, because I think it's really important, something you just mentioned, that maybe is underappreciated by a lot of people. And that is the idea that the total return is your return. That's first. Second of all, when we have a historical average of 10%, by the way, which I think most analysts that go on CNBC just use that to speculate what their year-end targets are going to be. I don't know how you feel about that, but it seems that 8 to 10% is the number they just stick on every time. Whatever the number is. Whatever it is. Let's see, 6,000? Yeah, we'll be 6,500 at the end of the year. That's our target. Oh, okay. How'd you get that? Well, we went through all of our, we did our work. We did the work. You know, the work.
Exactly.
The work. Uh-huh. They use that kind of weird phrase. We did the work. Our work, you know, what kind of work did you do? You just looked at historical numbers. You looked at what the thing is. The PE could be in this range, and that's where you got a range from it. Okay, fine. 10%, though, is made up of approximately 4% dividend yield and 6% growth of share value in the price value.
Yes, and we can break that down further. And it was about 5% from earnings growth and about 1% because the unknown fact is, or often under-recognized fact, is that when these indexes started back in the 1920s, 1926, the PE ratio was 10.2.
Uh-huh.
And today it's higher. So we've had this 90-year, 100-year history where there's where a little bit of a doubling or tripling of PE ratio added about 1% to total return. So yes, so let's go 4% dividends, 5% on earnings, and 1% on PEG.
So the point now is just to go back to the discussion, if currently the dividend yield is 1.5%, that means somehow magically we're going to need to get about 8.5%, give or take a little bit, from growth to meet the same things. And why do we think that is possible? That's a question.
Well, so a couple of things. One is we're starting at an elevated valuation level, a PE ratio that's, depending upon the measure that you use, 20 to 30 or more. That is relatively high. That is very upper decile of historical PE ratios. So we're starting out with one of our three factors at a point where it's not likely to continue. It's been surprising how far it's gone even in the last handful of years. But so that's a risk. The second is earnings growth. Earnings growth historically has correlated with economic growth, nominal economic growth, because all the companies together create the economy. And essentially the GDP, our measure of economic growth in the economy, is the sales of all companies in the aggregate. And then profits come from sales. So all these things are related through economics and finance. So that's the challenge, is how do you suddenly say we're going to go from a period where when we were having economic growth that was actually slightly higher than we are today, that looks like it's slowing down. Why do we think we're going to have faster profit growth? And if profit growth, here's a key point, if profit growth outruns economic growth, we're increasing even further an already historic high profit margin.
Yeah. But that sets us up for the idea that whether you're using something like even a long-term PE, like a CAPE ratio, right, or something like that, or
yes,
or even just a simple average over the last couple of years, or the current, whether you're using forward, backward, forward or past, whatever you're using, that's a knock against the opportunity that exists for the future.
Well, exactly. And so I think that's, let's see. One, I think the good news is that most analysts have come off the 10% expected return from stocks. I think you find that those that are more aggressive are somewhere in that 6 or 7, maybe a little more than that. They try to roll in some international and say that it can be, you know, in the upper end of that range. The more conservative group, whether it's Grantham or others, would have us believe that it's going to be a really, really tough period, that we're actually well into a secular bear.
By the way, I love Grantham. But is he kind of always a little bit negative or pessimistic or conservative? I don't know what you want to call it. It seems pessimistic. So I'm going to stay with pessimistic.
I'm going to attribute it to he's a long-term investor that recognizes the cycles of the market. And so therefore he sort of, he looks at the market reverting to a mean over time. And at this point, we're up in the cycle. So one of the reasons he's showing lower returns is he's expecting that at some point that we haven't, matter of fact, we haven't in kind of paraphrasing Irwin Fisher, we've not suddenly realized a new and permanent plateau, higher plateau for PE.
Mm. All right.
I think that's the other piece too. If we have, by the way, if PE is going to stay up at this level, it's going to keep dividend yield low or even lower over mm-hmm. time. We're talking about returns that are in the mid to lower single digits.
But
starting with high valuations has an effect.
Is the, we'll call it the modern corporate officer who mm-hmm. is looking to do as much as possible beneficial programs for shareholders, right? Shareholder-friendly programs of sorts. Have they maybe replaced some of the dividend payments, the higher dividend payments with share repurchases, share buybacks?
Well, the share buybacks are there. I think the reason for the lower dividend yield is not because the dividend payout from earnings is significantly lower. You see, one thing we can do, dividend yield is dividend over the price of the market, right? Over the price of the stock. Remember, dividends come from earnings. So there's a direct relationship between dividend yield and earnings yield, which is actually PE flipped on its head. The key point is, whenever you have high PE, you have low dividend yield, not because the dividend payout ratio goes down, but because you're paying so much more for each dollar of earnings and each dollar of dividends. And therefore, the percentage goes down. So right now, the low dividend yield is not about payout ratio. The money's not being diverted into buybacks. There's some money going to buybacks, but it's not enough it's relatively small compared to the effect that high valuations are having on low dividend yield.
Yeah. Yeah. So now, let's segue into a discussion that I know we talked about this last time you were on too in October of 2024. Let's talk about inflation. We saw some reports this week from CPI. We saw PPI. We saw, PCE. And there's a lot going on. We see the report, right? This exciting report. We saw the lowest level of inflation since 2021. I knew it. We could do it, right? But tell me what some thoughts you have on that.
Well, I think, so the what's interesting is the phenomenon that we talked about last time we were together is still there. And so last time we talked, I said, you know, inflation's going to peak here in the next couple of months, and then we're going to start falling and plunging into the first half of the first quarter of the year, first 4 or 5 months. And it wasn't that I had some insight about inflation upcoming. It's the only insight I had was about inflation past. So the number that gets reported is a year over year inflation number, which means it's 12 months. It's the trailing 12 months of monthly reports. So every time we get a new report, we add in a new month, but we drop off an old month. So the change in inflation on the annual report is the difference between what we add and what we take away. Make sense?
Yep, totally.
So what was coming up in the first part of this year was that we were averaging in the drop-off, we were dropping off numbers in the 6-7% per month range from a year ago. So even though inflation on a month-to-month basis was coming in at 3% or 5%, we still saw that annual number go down. Well, now turns out March, April, we pretty much kind of got rid of those big numbers. We have one last big number, well, a big number. The number coming up for the May report, which comes out in June, is we're going to be dropping off 2.01%, 2%. So if the on-the-ground month-to-month inflation rate for this next coming month is, for just that month, the stuff you see in the grocery store and you see at the car lot, if those numbers average anything more than 2%, then the inflation rate's going up. If it's less than 2%, it's going down. The number they report, the year-over-year number. Once we get past that month, we're looking at numbers like 0.4, 1.4, 1.0, 1.39. We're looking at for the next 4, 5, 6 months, an average of about 1% each month that'll drop off. Mm. So if inflation isn't, matter of fact, the Fed has been successful. If here's the fun part. If the Fed had been successful and suddenly we're now at 2% inflation, every month, 2% annualized each month for the next 4 or 5 months, we still would see inflation start rising back up again because we'd be dropping off numbers lower than 2 and adding in a 2.
But you know how this works. If inflation drops,
we may be headed back to about, we may see 3% again.
So if inflation drops off and it starts coming down, it's something that's good and that's something that should happen and it's, everything's working. If inflation starts going up, it's temporary phenomena.
Right.
I mean, that's what we hear. What's also interesting is about these tariffs, and I don't want to spend any much time on this, but the tariffs that talk about a one-time tax on or increase in pricing. The fact is, if we have a 10% tariff, only a 10% tariff and an increase in pricing of 10%, that's 3 to 4 years of inflation all sucked up into one. How is that going to look?
Well, except, you know, when you look at the, and I think that there's two things. One, you look at the magnitude of imports and exports in relation to what we, what all happens domestically. It dilutes down the effect of that significantly. Second is the 10% flat number you just described is going to be, it's more for some than less for others. We need to remember, just like what happens when the price of chickens goes up and people buy more pork than they do chicken because of the substitution effect. We're going to see some substitution effects happening. People moving some business around. We're not going to be buying the plastic toy from China if the tariff is really high. We'll buy the plastic toy from Vietnam or Taiwan or some other country. So I think the effect of tariffs, and anyway, I think what we're watching is a tariff process, not a tariff event. So we may ultimately end up, I think, with across the board, relatively modest effect, if any, from tariffs, but potentially an increase in the U.S. exports. I think that's where they're headed, is they're trying to get more U.S. exports to make up for our trade deficit. Bring jobs here to make stuff.
I've questioned the whole idea of we're going to bring jobs here because I was just talking about this earlier on another show that I was interviewed with. We have fat fingers. We're not making little widgets here. We're not sitting in hot factories. We're not getting minimum wage. We're a service-oriented economy rather than a manufacturing economy. I'm hard-pressed to believe that we're going to go back 30, 40 years into a time when we did more of the manufacturing and we had all that. We're service technology. We're a different country now, and we've offloaded all that pesky business of putting together that crib to, I don't know, pick it, Cambodia.
I don't think what they're trying to do is move the toy making business, the little trinket business, over to the U.S. from China, so we can sell more trinkets or make our own trinkets. I think what they're looking to do is to balance the trade deficit by saying, you know what, China, here's the deal: we make tractors, we make technology, et cetera. You know, we got to balance our trade deficit. I mean, that's the problem. You know, we need a trade deal that has us. Matter of fact, we need to go back to the original term. What's the word we keep throwing out here? Trade. It used to be trade. We would trade for things, right? Countries would trade for things. This idea of running deficits, that's the monetary phenomenon of the present, where we can offload onto other countries a lot of our debt. And I think there's a desire to instead bring the manufacturing back here and right-size that.
Lots of luck. Listen, I have a huge deficit with Amazon, and I don't think that's changing. They have something I want. I buy it from them. Does Amazon have something that they want from me? Not really. Well, they have the podcast, but they get that for free too, by the way. But you know, I don't necessarily think that this fair trade idea has to be an equalization of trade. That's what Navarro tried to put out, that whole reciprocal tariff thing that was just a disaster. But I understand what you're saying. I understand that we want to have more fairness. I can't argue with that. How can I argue with that, right? There's no sense in doing that.
Absolutely. So I think the tariff bears watching. I think it creates a lot of uncertainty, a lot of volatility right now. It is very disruptive. There were 200 countries that are affected, but realistically, it's one or two that are really a major part of that trade deficit that we have.
Yep.
And we know that, you know, China's the biggest one. And so I think at the end of the day, all eyes on China and what happens on the China trade deal. And do we come out of this with the same level of deficit, but just something different in tariffs? Or is there a difference in the trade deficit? I think that'll be a big, it'll have a, I think it'll have a, It's one more thing on the list. It's not going to have a major impact on our economy.
Yep.
But it's one more thing that will have an incremental benefit. And if nothing else, it's a, maybe we're, you know, we started off with psychology. Maybe a big part of this is just shifting the psychology to bring back some excitement and pride to the United States that might, you know, create some economic vigor.
I thought we had a pretty good economic vigor, but maybe I'm wrong. I thought things were pretty good the last 10 years. Well, with a couple of little hiccups here and there, which are normal. I mean, you can't go straight line, right?
Oh, you know, the one challenge is, you know, after we left the 2000, it was back in the late 1990s that I remember Greenspan talking about how this dot-com thing, he believed it was going to cause, up to that point, for the previous eight decades, we had averaged 3% real growth. And suddenly he thought we would go to 4% for at least the next decade or two.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, that's immediately when we shifted to our 2% real growth mode. Hmm. So 2 versus 3 may not sound like a lot, but boy, you start compounding that over time.
Yeah.
And it's a big number.
On a big number to begin with.
Yes, absolutely.
So I have two things I want to close with and ask you about. One, and you could take these in any order you want. I want to talk about the potential for this rising inflation, at least from a statistical measure, right? We'll look back. And how we can think about the Fed and how they're reacting, their general hawkishness, although this week they kind of softened a little bit, but generally speaking. And then I also want you to explain and talk about, and maybe blend this into the Cressman 6/50 rule.
Sure, absolutely. So I think the one big impact of this this temporary rise in inflation, and then by the way, we are set up for the first quarter of next year to show another decline, where we're going to drop off numbers in that 6%, 8% range each month. So key point is, I think while we're going through this next rise, so for the next handful of months between now and Thanksgiving, we are likely to see that slow rise would be the backdrop that would probably cause the Fed to go slow on dropping rates.
Mm-hmm.
I think for some reason, it feels like they have their back up a little bit anyway. But it my sense is that with that backdrop, it would not help their credibility. And since they're under a bit of attack from Washington, I think that they're going to be more conscious of their cognizant of their reputation than they might otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd look for a slight hawkish lean from the Fed. The 6/50 rule is something that Cressman publishes on its website. That shows the 6/50 rule is that on any 6-month period, interest rates somewhere along the yield curve, the term spectrum, move more than 50 basis points. So from today, we know that there's a certain set of interest rates out there. Short-term rates, the 6-month rate is around, something close to, or the 3-month anyway, is around 440 or 430. Let's say the 10-year, people watch that very closely, is somewhere around 4.5%. The 30-year is somewhere, you know, it's moving up closer to almost 5%. So within the next 6 months, between now and Thanksgiving, I will predict because history is a guide, that 97% of the time during that 6-month period, one of those interest rates I just mentioned will be up or down more than 50 basis points. Now, if it wasn't so significant, in other words, 97%, most so common to happen, it wouldn't be worth speculating on where it might happen. Well, if the Fed is unlikely to drop rates on the short end by 2 cuts between now and Thanksgiving,
mm-hmm.
the reality would be that we can't expect that 3 months to move. So now we're talking about it's either going to be somewhere around the 7-year or somewhere around the 30-year. You know, with this backdrop of a hawkish Fed and with this rising interest rate environment that would keep them hawkish, it seems like that's going to signal to the bond market that the Fed is trying to control or fight inflation. That would probably keep a lid on the mid and short-term rates. And so I'm going to predict right now that it's either mid or long-term rates that will break the 50 basis point barrier between now and Thanksgiving. Sometime between now and Thanksgiving, we will see probably one of those interest rates with a 3 handle, even if just briefly.
Wait, we're going to go down?
Down, yeah.
But how do we get that if we have hawkish, if there's a hawkish Fed and there's inflation and they're keeping a lid on it? Why wouldn't those potentially move up?
Well, this is the phenomenon that affected what they called at the time the Greenspan conundrum about why when the Fed was moving rates one direction, Did we see interest rates? Did we see long rates go the other direction? So I subscribe to the view that the long-term interest rates are driven by inflation expectations. Mm-hmm. If inflation expectations are declining, or we don't expect inflation to go up or up significantly, then we would expect the longer-term rates to go down and to be more in line with a declining inflation expectation level.
Okay, got it.
If the Fed comes in, and again, this is, if the Fed were to keep interest rates up here and not drop rates, that's a signal that they're going to try to control that inflation back to 2%. It's showing that even though we're seeing a print of 2.4 and then 2.5, then 2.6, they're saying we're remaining vigilant, right? By not cutting rates, we are committed to 2%. And if they keep signaling we're committed to 2, despite the rise in those rates, that signal is going to be interpreted by the bond market to say the Fed's not letting this go out of control on the upside. We may even see some speculative press talk about, is the Fed's next move going to be a rise and not a fall, right, in rates?
Mm-hmm.
Only because it's going to take so long for that rise to peak. We've got 6 months in front of us of, I'm not saying every month is going up, right? We could see 1 month go up 2 ticks and then the next month come down a tick. But the general trend, I think it's going to be noticeably higher by Thanksgiving than it is now.
But
Absent a recession.
Wait, it's going to be higher, but we just talked about it being lower.
I'm sorry. Good clarification. The inflation rate reports will be higher.
Uh-huh.
But because the inflation rates reports are going to be higher, because the Fed will likely not cut rates significantly into that rising inflation rate, maintain credibility, that will be interpreted by the bond market that they are being vigilant to get back to their 2%. And therefore, we're likely to see a lid. I wouldn't see rates going up 50 basis points. So
you remember, do understand my, this is backward mentality, right?
It is. No.
I just want to make sure we're clear about that because I'm like going, okay.
Okay. So, and by the way, my prediction of down is not as much because I think it's going down. It's because I think it's going to move 50 basis points.
Right.
And it's not going to be on the short end.
Right.
So therefore, if it's moving 50, 97% chance, and it's not going to be on the short end, it's got to be in the mid or long end. Because of the Fed staying hawkish and because inflation's going up, I just don't see that we're going to see a 50 basis points on the long end. Could be totally wrong.
So therefore we'd probably end up in a inverted yield curve again.
We could get pretty close to flat. Absolutely.
Yeah. Or flat. Either one is not good. I mean, generally speaking, it's not good for economic growth.
Absolutely not. But we should not dismiss. And again, I'm not trying to predict or message any negativity, but we do have a more elevated view about the risk of recession is still less than 50%.
Mm-hmm.
But it is higher than it was at the first of the year. And if we were to see softening economic conditions or the risk of recession, then obviously our discussion changes significantly. It was really in the context of a non-recessionary environment.
Mm-hmm. Interesting stuff. Where can people get more information about you, your company, your newsletters, your things, everything you do?
Thanks, Andrew. Yes, at CrestmontResearch.com. That's all one word, CrestmontResearch.com.
Good stuff.
And in the website's free and open access. It's very much public information. If people are interested, we do have a notification that goes out every time there's an update to the website. It's typically quarterly. And that notification is free. Just enter your email address. The only way it's used is just for the notification. There is no marketing behind it. But that's at the top of every webpage.
Good.
on the website.
Good.
And what folks will find is three quarters of the material will be charts and graphs that are updates from unexpected returns and probable outcomes. And they'll also find articles that are written to the intended to be at the layman level, to help folks understand some of the principles of what drives stock market returns and what drives interest rates and the economy over time.
Good stuff. Ed Easterling, thank you so much for spending the time with us this week. And we're going to get you back on another few months. Let's see how it goes. Actually, let's do it. I can't believe we're talking about Thanksgiving already, by the way. But let's do it after Thanksgiving. And let's see. Let's remember this 650. Remember the 650. Let's see how it comes out. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Andrew. All right. All the best.
And there you have it. The Disciplined Investor, bringing you consistency, bringing you great topics, great information on strategy, how to make sure that you are there. Great episode with Ed Easterling there. Really enjoy him. We have some great things happening over the next few weeks, by the way, some great guests that are going to be coming up. So you don't want to miss that. We have Tom Nelson, Barry Ritholtz. We have Frank Curzio, Steve Sanders. Lots and lots and lots of great things lined up over the next several months. And of course, if you have any questions, I want you to ask. Who knows? It could end up on the show. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Click on the Ask Andrew button. It's that easy. And send it on in. Thanks for joining me this week and every week, and I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates.